ones that made you go to the moon, the ones that made you go to the Mars, they will remember this kind of genius engineer and then some guy who made a lot of money in Silicon Valley that was now thinking about their legacy. And never in my wildest imaginations could I imagine that all I had to do was combine the two characters into one. It's Elon Musk.
So how important is it for humans to establish a new home on another planet? Today, we'll be speaking with an aerospace engineer and robotics expert to find out why Mars is the best option. We'll take a closer look at all the companies and technologies that Elon Musk has created, including SpaceX, Tesla, Neuralink, Twitter, and The Boring Company, and see how they each bring something of value to the goal of colonizing Mars. I'm looking forward to relearning more about reusable rockets, robots, electric vehicles, brain-computer interfaces, underground tunnels, solar panels, and energy storage. How will we produce food and water, generate energy, and provide protection from the harsh Martian environment? We'd also need to be able to manufacture our own equipment and infrastructure using resources available on Mars, and we'd need to find ways to communicate within Mars and back to Earth. Elon Musk has made that one of his top goals. He has warned that if humans don't create a backup plan, there are a wide range of possible catastrophes, like, for example, a global war, asteroid impact, or climate change that risk the chance for the only known consciousness to be lost. So today we're joined by Dr. Scott Walter. Thank you, Scott, for joining me again.
Hello, Herbert. Thank you for having me back.
So Scott is an aerospace engineer with a PhD in mechanical engineering. He co-founded two robotics companies in the past, Deneb Robotics and Visual Components. Scott has worked on projects for NASA, aerospace and defense, shipbuilding, automotive, and robotics. I've had Scott on this channel before when we talked about TeslaBot, and he shared some incredible never-before-seen proof that the bot is likely already working in Tesla's factories. Scott, thank you for coming in and helping me get brighter about how Elon and his companies will help humans live, work, and thrive in Mars. Okay, thank you, Scott, again. Appreciate this. So, you know, very first question I need to know is, why did they choose Mars? And is it even possible that Mars will be habitable and someplace that humans can actually somehow be able to live in?
It's a tall order, but yes, it can. It will require, you know, the best of humanity to be able to do it, and all our energy is sort of focused on that. But long term, it does make sense. And you always have to start somewhere or it will never get done. So we will make the baby steps right now. And, you know, whether we're going to have a completely verdant Mars by the end of our lifetime or our grandchildren's lifetime, that's a ways out, but you got to start. And a lot of people will say, well, why not do the moon? Why should we do Mars? Mm-hmm. And there's pros and cons to both. One of them is, it looks like Mars has an atmosphere that the moon doesn't, not much of an mm-hmm. atmosphere, but it's something that we can work with. And it has a slightly stronger gravity, and it may have more resources. So the moon's resources are a little bit deprived. And so we'd be able to find a little bit more in Mars. The other possibility, of course, why don't we do Venus? Well, Venus is described pretty much as a hellscape. There's no way we could really get down to the surface of Venus and do anything. We would have to do severe terraforming of Venus before we could go there. Mars, we can do it after the fact. It's going to be a little bit tough at first. It's going to be like Antarctica on its coldest night when it's summertime on Mars. So we're not talking about something that's really easy, and it is very far away. But there are challenges, and I think we're up to it, and I think it can be done. And I think just for reasons of curiosity and wanderlust and everything else, it just makes sense. You know, and
makes sense. Yeah. So tell me about this photo. You're telling me that this is what Mars looks like today, and somehow, really, it's going to be able to look like this
someday in the future. It's a lot of scientists believe so, others not. So it's a hot topic of debate on whether that could be done. And I don't mean it as a pun, because obviously it has to get a little bit warmer to be able to do this and have a thicker atmosphere. And today we'll sort of talk about what those first steps might be able to get there. And, you know, mm-hmm. what the time frames are. So there's some people that think it could be done in a reasonable time frame, and others might say it's very unreasonable. It would take a very, very long time to do that. And with the technology we have today, it will be very tough to do. But that's the whole idea of going there, is to develop new technologies and to see what we can do and to create new ideas, absolutely new industries, give humanity a chance to, you know, really stretch out and see what we can do and use this as a springboard for the colonizing the rest of the solar system. Because, I mean, why not? There's just so much to learn.
Why? Before we get there, let's talk about Mars still. I guess you have to do, you do have to tell me, like, what is the plan? And first you said moon and then from moon to Mars and the time frame. But just before we go there, tell me about, like, what got you interested in Mars? Why did you start reading up on this? What is your knowledge and how did you get this knowledge?
Okay, well, I'm a child of the 60s. And of course, you know, in 1969, this event happened. Okay. And I was 11 years old when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed on the moon. You know, it's one of those days that I can remember. I knew exactly where I was. My brothers know exactly where they were because we were all there together. And it was definitely something that I already was interested in before the landing happened. So probably when I was 8 or 9, it was really getting into it. I was building all these, you know, the Revell models of the Saturn V and the Gemini and the Mercury spacecraft and everything, and knew all the facts. In fact, when you know, when you're first having to take books out from grade school, and when you go up to the school librarian, all the boys were asking for books on Davy Crockett, and I was asking for books on the Navy rocket. and so that's pretty much what I was doing and what I preferred to read and wanted to study. And the reason why this National Geographic is important is if you go back to it for a second, you'll see that it says up there that it's December 1969, but they landed in July. Mm. But the thing about National Geographic is it wasn't about covering current events. That was what Life magazine was for. But it was about actually doing a deep dive into what happened. So you found out a lot about, you know, what was kind of the aftermath of being there. They could really go into it. And what was really important to a lot of us was like this one article that was written by Thomas O'Payne, who was the NASA administrator at that time, of what the next steps are. And the next steps were going to Mars. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was talking about that. And now when Apollo happened, I was 11 years old. And I was really disappointed. I was just too young. It's like, oh, I wish I was older. Maybe I could have been the first man on the moon. So at that point, it's like, well, my goal is to be the first man on Mars, right? Then I read this article and it was absolutely crestfallen because you can see the dates that he's talking about here. Oh, the window is going to open in October 1983, you know, and they're going to land in 1984 after about a 9-month journey there. So everything is laid out and I'm doing the math. It's like, I'll only be in my mid-20s. I'll be too young again. Okay. So be careful what you wish for. So, you know, now it's the other way. It's like, oh, you know, by the time we really do it, I might be a bit too old. But I've got an answer for that. Yeah. That we'll get to. So that certainly got me started, that, you know, that realizing we're going to do it. The problem is, and he explains in there, is that NASA did not have a directive to do it, but they've already kind of thought the whole process out. And they're kind of a hint, hint, nudge, nudge. We're waiting for Congress to back this up. Mm. Now, can you name the first politician who actually proposed that we should go to Mars?
It's not Kennedy, or was it Kennedy?
It wasn't Kennedy. You know, Kennedy was the moon.
The moon.
But who do you think was the first politician? No, politician. Because there were a lot of people that said we should go to the moon.
Yeah.
Okay, Buzz Aldrin was not. Nope. He was never elected. So, you know, a politician. A lot of people would be surprised. You might have thought it was Nixon or Reagan. Okay. No, it wasn't.
Yeah.
It was actually Spiro Agnew, the vice president. Nixon's vice president. It was more or less like a trial balloon because he said he was advocating for funding to go to Mars because he thought that'd be the next thing. And that's about as far as it got. So the Vietnam War was going on. Funding was being cut back from Apollo. So, you know, we ended at Apollo 17. And it was very clear we weren't going to go that route. And so things kind of continued on. You had kind of the malaise of the 70s. And then, you know, and it was kind of a sad time, the end of the 70s, because Jimmy Carter was the last American president in which there were no Americans in space while he was during his term of president. It wasn't until Reagan that we were able to get the space shuttle to go up. And it was almost like a rocket to nowhere. It's like, oh, we're going to low Earth orbit. What are we doing it for? And there were some exciting projects, you know, like Hubble and building a space station. But it just didn't capture the imagination. Everyone's waiting for it. And then I can remember it was like late 90s. And there was a PBS special with Alan Alda. And he was talking about this mission to Mars. And I was like absolutely intrigued. It's like, wow, on network television, they're actually talking about space, because there had been nothing about that. It was like everything else, but no one's really caring about it. It's like the first time. And he was talking about this idea from this aerospace scientist named Dr. Robert Zubrin and his book, Mars Direct. And of course, the next day, I ran out to the bookstore and bought the book. Okay. All right. Yeah. That's this book right here. Wow. Yeah, we actually did that back in those days. And so I bought that. And I can trust you that Elon Musk already had a copy of this book way before that. Mm. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I just devoured it. And it was very interesting what he talked about. And there was another politician who proposed or was about to propose a mission to Mars. And that would be the first Bush Sr. in 1990. And they ended up getting a committee together to kind of study the feasibility of a manned mission to Mars and how much it would cost. And they came back to HW and told him $400 billion. And, you know, it was like, what? You know, there's no way Congress is going to save $400 billion. And of course, you know, whenever they come up with an estimate, there's a factor of two or three involved. And that's like on the way up, not the way down. So realistically, the proposal would probably be in the order of $1 trillion or more. And so he knew that was not going to fly and it wasn't going to work. And the thing is, Robert Zubrin was aware of kind of what that proposal was. And he saw they were doing it completely wrong. So he had a very, very different approach to it. So what was wrong with the Bush one was what Robert Zubrin describes as the Battlestar Galactica approach. In other words, they were going to build this huge spaceship in Earth orbit and then use that to go to Mars. And it would be the analogy of that when the first explorers came over to the New World, rather than doing it on the Viking longships like it was, they said, nah, we're not going to do it till we build a Carnival cruise liner. Okay. So yeah, that's their approach. It's like, we're going to make this really big thing. So it's very different than Payne's idea that you would have a 6-man crew with like two almost Apollo-like modules that are going there to be able to go in there and come back. So Zubrin studied it and he realized, no, it could be done for a lot less. And he thought it could be done for $2 billion. So that he was maybe a bit low, but still $2 billion. And he was taking this different analogy. And the reason why he's calling it direct is that a lot of the problem was that when you go to the moon, you have to bring everything that you need when you go to the moon to be able to come back. Mm-hmm. But he's saying that's not the way the explorers did it. So Lewis and Clark, when they did the Oregon Trail, they didn't bring all the water and all the food they needed. They foraged along the way. They just brought kind of what they needed for their starter kit. And then, you know, when they needed supplies, they figured out a way to set up a camp and resupply. And so he was looking at that problem and saying that, well, one of the problems of doing the trip is that the fuel we need to come back, we got to bring with us, which means our rockets have to be even bigger to bring the fuel that we need for the return trip. So why not actually make the fuel on Mars? Now that meant thinking very differently, because up to that time, most rockets either used hydrogen or they used kerosene. And hydrogen is not widely available on Mars as far as we know. If it is, it's going to be in water form. Before we can tell, there's like none of it in the atmosphere. It's not readily accessible. And kerosene, well, that's a fossil fuel. And I'm not sure you're going to find that on Mars. And if you do, you're going to have to set up a refinery and everything else. So there had to be some other solution. And that's when they realized, well, the Martian atmosphere is made up primarily of carbon dioxide. And there is this famous process out there called the Sabatier process, which knows how to convert with hydrogen carbon dioxide into methane with, I think, a byproduct of hydrogen along with it. So not hydrogen, of oxygen. So you would get oxygen out of it. So it was like, wow, this is a great idea. We can take the atmosphere of Mars and turn it into the propellant that we need to go back. And it also will become kind of a fuel source. So we can produce it and we get oxygen. So that means the oxygen that we need to breathe, we don't have to bring it with us. It's just going to be there. The only thing we need is energy. So the idea is that they're...
You want to show the paper there? I guess the question I've got away is that, so you're saying that Elon likely read this book and do you think that everything you just said... Everything you just said in the last 5 minutes here is likely the way it's going to happen?
Yes, it absolutely is. Because, you know, Elon has said that and Robert Zubrin has said that, and they are good friends. They talk all the time about that. So absolutely. So Elon was inspired a lot by this, as well as everyone else. So
you want to show the paper? Yeah.
So somewhere down here is this process right here, which is the Sabatier process. Actually, so this is the Sabatier reaction where you just take CO2, add some hydrogen, and you're able to get, see, in one case, yeah, I guess you get water out of it. So you get the water, not the oxygen, sorry. So you get the water that you need out of it as well. And so you need those consumables there, which means you don't have to bring it all. All you have to do is bring the hydrogen with you. So that's part of the idea, is that we need some hydrogen, but you don't need as much hydrogen as you normally would need for the return trip. And you don't need the oxidizer. So it's like, gotcha. And there's a way to be able to produce the oxygen as well. So that was the idea of kind of living off the land approach. We produce mm-hmm. what we want. And Zubrin's plan was that you first send on when one of the Mars windows opens up, unmanned missions that go there with a reactor that actually start fueling up everything, because it takes a long time to do it. It could take 18 months for this process to work, to do everything for the return trip. So you make sure everything is working, and then you send the manned crews there. And when they land in the same area, and now they have a rocket ready to go. And of course, right after, you know, that was also the inspiration for this other book here called The Martian by Andy Weir.
The movie?
It became a movie. It was first a book. And the thing about it is that he basically wrote the book that I wanted to write, because as soon as I saw Zubrin's, idea, I said, the only thing that's missing is capturing the public imagination. Someone's got to write a narrative, a book about it that will capture everyone's mind. And I'm the type of person that, while I like a certain amount of science fiction, I like it to be more in science fact than total fiction with all these weird alien monsters and stuff like that. And if you notice on the book, if you go back to it, you'll notice that Andy Weir does not call it a science fiction. It's called a novel.
Oh, okay.
Because it's really based on a lot of facts. And so it's not really science fiction, because he's really saying that this could happen. This is, you know, while it's fictional, it's not science fictional. Everything that's there. And you know, my feeling was like, oh yeah, someone's going to capture the public imagination, which he did. And a few years ago, Andy Weir was interviewed by Joe Scott, and they were talking about the writing process and everything else. And Andy Weir was saying, well, what you got to do is, like, every day you've got to, you know, write. You got to write a couple of pages, because if you don't, otherwise you're daydreaming. And he basically described what I had been doing for like 10 years, is that, you know, I had imagined the whole scenario. I knew what it was. I had like a book in my head that, like, I was the only person that read this book, because it was like in my head, but never really being committed, with all these ideas on how it would work. And I kind of had it set up. And I'm going to ask you a very simple question, Herbert. How many European royals can you name from 500 years ago?
None. Zero.
For the past. I mean, you might be able to say, oh, there's like, you know, there's a Queen Elizabeth in there, and there's some Henry VIII, right? And maybe, then you might be able to say, oh, there was like a Louis XVI, so there's going to be a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You know, it's like, that's cheating, all right? So as far as like you really thinking of some that have made such an impact that later generations can answer them, there is one. I mean, if you really think about it, and there was a queen, and she was from Spain, and her name was Isabella, right? Ferdinand and Isabella. Yeah. And why do you remember them today?
Sure. Well, we know why.
Yes.
Because now, they're the ones that discovered a new land or paid for the ships.
In their day, every single member of the royal families throughout Europe, they were like the most important people of their day, yet they're completely forgotten today. So who are the ones that are remembered? So now answer the question, which American presidents you think will be remembered 500 years from now?
Sure. Yeah. You're going to say Kennedy, right?
You're going to get Washington in there, because it's the first
of
one.
Of course.
Probably Lincoln.
Yeah.
And Kennedy. All right. So, so, you know, the imagination is like, what do you do to become that kind of person? So I'm thinking like, okay, the problem with going to Mars is at first you need a guy who's like really smart. And then you also need like a lot of money, and like the government's not going to do it. But the thing that Zubrin pointed out, and this is what like kind of shocked me, is he said, oh, it could be done for $2 billion. And that's when I almost fell on my chair. This is like 1997. I'm like, $2 billion. That could be privately funded. I mean, there are billionaires out there that they can write the check tomorrow and do that. And I think it was like, all you have to do is go up and persuade one of them that, you know, this is your Ferdinand and Isabel moment. This is the one that is going, like, 500 years from now, they're going to remember you. You know, the Rockefellers and the Carnegies, they're going to be in the Vanderbilts. They'll be forgotten 500 years from now, because while they did great things and they were these big industrialists, the grand scheme of things are going to be forgotten. So the ones that made you go to the moon, the ones that made you go to the Mars, they will remember. So I can imagine, aha, that's how you go ahead and do it. So that was like my plot line. It's like I had this kind of genius engineer, and then some guy who made a lot of money in Silicon Valley that was now thinking about their legacy. And never in my wildest imaginations could I imagine that all I had to do was combine the two characters into one. You know,
yeah, it's like Elon, you know, can
it's
do it.
Elon Musk. And this is kind of changes. And this is where I think we might want to do a little bit different approach of what Zubrin is that he's thinking of the problem of going to Mars and back. And it actually, he got a lot of pushback from a lot of people in the society of within the scientific community for, I guess, what you would call his exuberance. Okay, a little bit of a pun there, because he's so passionate about it. You just listen to him talk because it's just amazing. Problem is, he stepped on a lot of toes, and all the toes he stepped on absolutely deserved to be stepped on. And they were like, oh, we can't do that because biocontamination. If you come back here, or the return trip's going to be really hard. You've got all, you know, the radiation hazards on the way out and the way back and everything like that. So there's all these reasons why you can't do it. And the other thing to remember is a lot of the cost of these mission is not the mission to go there. It's the mission to go there and back. And two-thirds of your energy and cost is figuring out how do you come back. If you look at any mission profile, they're talking about 9 months out, and minimum maybe 90 days or up to 18 months actually in Martian orbit before the window opens up before you can come back. So it's like, well, wait a minute. If you can survive 18 months up there on Mars, I bet you can find a way to stay up there for 18 years. So I was starting to think, it's going to be a one-way trip. So that's what my novel was going to be about. It's like, it's a one-way trip that you're just going to go there and do it that way. Now, the other thing to think about is that all the hazards that are going on, you've got radiation exposure when you're actually doing the journey out there. The possibility of cancers and everything else is that when people come back, you know, their health might be really bad. So this whole idea that we get this generation of astronauts who are like in the prime of their life, they're 35, they got a couple of young ones at home and stuff like that, and we're going to send them off on this 3 or 5 year mission, however long it comes back, and who knows what's going to happen. It'd be absolutely tragic that people that age, you know, would come back, and it's like, no one's going to go into that because they're going to just see it as a suicide mission. So I'm thinking like, you know, who should we be sending? We should be sending people who don't have attachments back home. They don't have family that they were are thinking about, or would have like this regret halfway there. Oh, should I have really gone? And there's no turning around. Once you go, you're committed. And so I'm thinking, you know what? Mars should be the ultimate 55 plus community. and the idea is that, and of course you have to worry about how people get along and everything else. And so there are a lot of couples in academia that have like the scientific experience and background and training that almost would be perfect for going there. So that's like the mission profile I'm sort of thinking. They may not be charismatic enough to kind of like get the, you know, a lot of the public imagination because they want something else. But that was a feeling. And of course, when I pitched this idea to my family, and never pitch an idea to your family, all right, because they will always shoot it down. They're like, that sounds crazy. No one would ever want to do that. And obviously, they never looked like the waiting list to spend like a year in Antarctica. You know, there are people who want to do it. And so they thought it was a crazy idea until then I suddenly hear, I think it was like a Science Friday in around 2003 or something like that. And Lawrence Krauss, who's a professor from the University of Arizona, suggests the exact same thing. We should just go one way and not come back. And like, no, why didn't they, you know? So that's he came idea. Up, you know, because he had the courage to get it out there. And as soon as he did that, you know what happened? Like 100,000 people signed up. Yeah, we'll go. So it's not that crazy. And there's a lot of reasons you'd want to do that. So we're not talking about necessarily full-blown colony like everyone wants, but probably a scientific outpost that will take years to get up to the stage that you can then get, you know, what Elon's vision is. But at first you got to start there. You got to find out what kind of resources and everything else. And that's like my long-winded introduction of what's going on. And now we should start deep diving in some of the technology and aspects that you're sort of thinking about are going to be
fantastic. Well, it's a good setup. I mean, you explained how it all worked and you explained how the thinking is. So yeah, Elon Musk, all of his technologies, how would they work? Do you want to go in order of, you know, leaving Earth and then arriving there? Or do you want to do it on segments of, you know, different topics?
Well, I mean, the first thing that everyone kind of wonders is like, well, how do we get there? What's the mission profile?
Yeah.
And I'll show this. I think you can go ahead and show this right now. I don't know if you are aware that this is the picture of the back of a T-shirt, a Starlink T-shirt, right? And it's the same thing here that you'll see on the Starlink router. Okay. Yeah. What's this got to do with Starlink? Well, almost nothing. What this is known as is the Hohmann transfer orbit. So what you're seeing in the center of the picture is the sun, And the inner circle is the orbit of the Earth. The outer circle is the orbit of Mars. And the circle that connects those two is what's known as the Hohmann transfer orbit. That's the most energy efficient orbit to be able to go from Earth to Mars. And it's only when the two planets sort of line up in a particular way that you have what they call the window that you can actually launch there. And that happens about every 2 years. Maybe it's like every 25 months or every 26 months as possible, roughly every 2 years. And the way to look at it is that I like to use the analogy of a quarterback and a wide receiver, right? Is there's a timing pattern that you have. So you get the wide receiver who is in motion going behind the quarterback, and the quarterback, you know, gets the snap from the center, who is the sun, you know, and he's kind of rolling out a little bit while the running back is running behind him. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. as soon as the running back gets to a certain position, he throws the pass. But he doesn't mm-hmm. throw it to where the wide receiver is. He's throwing it to where the wide receiver will be. So the timing has to be just right, that if you decide that you want them to match up, you know exactly where it is. And a good quarterback can do it blindfolded. You know, they just close their eyes and know exactly what the pattern is. They work in that. It's all about timing. And it's the same thing when you want to go from Earth to Mars, is you have to wait until your wide receiver has kind of like crossed the line of scrimmage, is at a certain location. So to go from low Earth orbit to the Martian orbit, to bring yourself up there, you need to transfer into that higher orbit, and the amount of time it will take you to do that is roughly 9 months. Mm-hmm. And so what that means is that you have to do it when Mars is about halfway from the position that you're going to intercept at. So, or not, sorry, 9 months back. So you would back it back a little bit 9 months. Right. So it's not behind yeah. Earth. It's kind of come around Earth a little bit, and it's like, oh, we're nine months away. Start to throw the pass and you go ahead there. Now, the other thing about a pass is a good pass for a quarterback is you want to make sure it's just like a really soft pass. It just lands right in his hand so he doesn't fumble it. And this is the other problem, is that you don't want to come in with too much energy. So you can get to Mars a lot faster. The problem is you need the brakes. Otherwise, you're going to overshoot. So there's a certain amount of retro that you're going to need, which either could be aerobraking. You actually go in the atmosphere to try to slow yourself down, or you're going to have to waste some propellant to be able to slow yourself down to get into a capture orbit around there. So there's a lot of different mission profiles. But that's basically why we only have this window of opportunity every 24 months. Without a much more powerful propulsion system, you know, like they're proposing, like nuclear, there's no way we'd be able to do it other than this for now. So that's why, you know, what's the next one? 2025 or something like that. And so mm-hmm. about every 2 years is one. So okay. that is how we get
SpaceX
there.
SpaceX is going to do this. They're testing out their their rocket now, right? And then do you think they'll make it for the next round? And then, why did, I mean, Starlink is owned by SpaceX, so maybe that's the reason why they do this. Or is there another signal maybe that Starlink is going to be critical?
Because the transmission between Earth and Mars is very long. Sometimes you're very close. Sometimes I think you might be as close as maybe it might be like 5 or 10 minutes away. And then other times it's more than 20 minutes away. So depending on where they are in the orbit, if they're in kind of, you know, conjunction very close, then it's a much shorter transmission signal. But if on the opposite side of the sun, you know, which you're kind of seeing in this picture, and in those cases, you actually can't transmit, because when it's directly behind the sun, signals are lost. So there's one thing is you need to have that line of sight. It's going to take, you know, maybe up to 20 minutes to go one way and then to get the return signal. So you know how that is when you have a satellite lag, as it is here on Earth, everyone complains about, imagine a 20-minute signal. So everything is going to have to almost be text-based, or, you know, a video file or something like that, because you're not going to have a one-to-one kind of conversation like what we're having. The other thing is, like, what do you do when the sun's in the middle and it's critical you have the transmission? But the last thing is the data rates are very, very slow. So the amount of data that you can transmit is extremely slow. So you don't want to be thinking, well, how can we improve that? And a lot of the problem is because, you know, the radio signals attenuate out. You've got to have these big radio telescopes to be able to capture the information. They're going to be in the right part of the planet for that to happen. It's really slow. Well, there might be some things we can do to speed it up, at least the data rates. And that is, like, you do laser connections. So you would need to have some satellites to bounce them off. So obviously on Mars, if you start to have a colony or at least explorers around there, they need to be able to communicate. And in many cases, you might upload something to some satellites that are in the orbit, and then they can beam those things directly back to Earth or to some intermediate satellite somewhere that it bounces off. Starts to sound a lot like the Starlink constellation, doesn't it? You know, And the question is, where are those things going to go? And we're going to point to that in a few cases of where those satellites might be positioned. Now, we can see there's a lot of things that we're going to do, is that we're going to have to create our own rocket fuel if we want to get back. But that rocket fuel is going to be useful for other things than just rocket fuel, because it's methane. So that means you can use it for powering rovers if necessary, for heating and everything else. So it'll be a store of energy. And the thing is, these processes are going to require power. They're going to require energy. So the biggest problem you're going to have on Mars is it's going to be an energy crisis, because you're going to need energy in order to be able to take those resources and convert them into something that you need. We need oxygen. Hopefully we'll be able to find water, or we're going to have to make the water through the Sabatier process and be able to create the methane. Ironically, at first, you know, looking at it, it's like, well, we know solar will work there because it already has kind of proven itself. But you have to kind of put it a little bit in perspective, is that Mars is a little bit further from the sun. It's 1.5 times the distance from the sun, which means you have to square that to find out what the actual amount is coming in is and take the reciprocal of that. So square of that is like 2.25, the reciprocal of that, 44%. So that means Mars sees 44% of the amount of incoming sunlight, which means your solar panels are suddenly only 44% of what you're used to having here on Earth. So it's like, it's already, you know, right around where it might be acceptable. Is that going to be all right? The other thing to remember is that on Mars, we're going to be on the equator. And most people with their solar panels, they're in mid-latitudes. So being at the equator, it's already going to be a little bit. So that will give you almost a 30% improvement over where the typical solar panels are on the Earth. So it's like, oh, you bump that up. So maybe we're around 50% there. The other thing is that we lose a lot of that solar energy coming into the atmosphere. Mars doesn't have much of an atmosphere. So you might want to think about thickening that atmosphere if you don't want your solar panels to go down in performance. So the thin atmosphere means we're getting more coming in. The other thing is, solar panels tend to perform really poorly when they get hot, get very warm, on very sunny days, ironically. So if they overheat, Mars, you're not going to have that problem. They'll probably stay pretty cool. So that means we'll get decent performance out of them. The only thing we have to worry about is the Martian dust always getting on them. And if we're there, we're able to clean them up into it. So we'll be able to get it. But the one problem with solar, what is the problem with solar, Herbert?
What is the problem with solar? You keep asking me these questions. I don't know.
Yeah, this is something that Amy and Bradford have been talking a lot about. And that is,
only works during the daytime. Store it. Oh, it works in the daytime, of course. But I assume that because you're in Mars. Yeah, you need to store it. But I assume because you're in, right.
Yep. Yeah, you absolutely need to store it, right. So that's going to be one of the things that you need to have. And so you need to say, well, what's going to be the best way to store this energy? And, you know, thinking about it, it's like, well, they do use batteries for the most part. There are some. But for the amount of battery storage, I'm not sure if you can do it. And it might almost make sense to do it the old-fashioned way, since we've got the Sabatier process and we have to do all these other things. It may be that we have to go to a lot of methane production for the energy storage that we're going to have there, because we're going to be using the methane for everything else. Now, a lot of times people will scream and holler, it's so bad because you're losing so much going this way and back. It's all getting generated into heat. Well, let me tell you, the biggest problem you're going to have on Mars is heating. So if you build all these systems right, there is no such thing as waste heat. That waste heat is just going to be used for everything else you need. So it may be that things will be, you know, there'll be the solar, but it's not clear how much you're going to have the batteries there. And the other bad news about heating is that, forget about heat pumps. They're not going to work on Mars for a couple of reasons. It's too cold.
What? I was assuming that Tesla's heat HVAC will be able to
use. We'll see. If they can get an HVAC to work in Antarctica, you might have a chance. Mm-hmm. But the outside temperature is just too cold. You're talking, you know, in the best, like around 0 degrees centigrade, but it's much, much lower. But even if you have it up around 0 degrees, there's another problem. The Martian atmosphere is so thin. So the actual thermal mass is like, there's almost nothing there. So you could have like, I think in the summertime in the equator, it might get up to 70 degrees. But the heat content is so little because the density term that's in there is practically nothing. So there's almost nothing to extract from. So it'll be very hard to get it. So the other thing is like, well, then just take it from the ground. Just do geothermal. And it's like, well, it's not called geothermal on Mars. It's called, I think, aerial thermal. I'm not even sure if that's a word, but it's, you know, from Aries. and the ground is pretty cold. I tried looking it up and there's like, yeah, the ground temperature at the surface is like minus 55 degrees centigrade. Wow. So yeah, that's not a really good heat source unless you come up with some kind of heat pump cycle that could actually work in that. Now, it's not absolute zero. So it's literally, it is better than nothing. And who knows, maybe they're going to work in a process can do it, but the efficiency of a heat pump at that point goes way, way, way down. So you're probably going to have some of these nuclear reactors and everything else. But you know, I'm thinking you also want to have some sort of battery storage. And this is where it kind of got me thinking, is that do we want to send megapacks to Mars? Does it make sense to send a megapack to Mars? It'd be nice to have a megapack on Mars for sure, for all that solar collection.
Can you make a megapack on Mars? Does it have lithium? Does it have
the thing? Is it makes absolutely no sense, because that is so heavy to put there. So I'd say, no, you wouldn't put it there. The question is, do we have it? I think there might be lithium. I'm pretty sure, because Mars is red, gives a lot of that red from the iron. So there's plenty of iron. Mm-hmm. And which battery chemistries work best in the cold?
LFP.
LFP. Okay. Yeah, so not lithium ion, lithium but iron. LFP.
Yeah.
And you don't really care that much about, you know, for normal kind of storage, you don't care about the mass that much. Plus, it's 1/3 gravity. So if you do put it on a vehicle, it's like, who cares? You know, it's a lot lighter. So that's not going to be a big deal. So you want something that has pretty good cold weather performance, something that cycles really well, something you can bring up and down, and it maybe is made from local minerals. There might be some lithium around there. Have to check, because lithium is not, it should be available, because it's like the third element. You know, you get helium, you get hydrogen, helium, and lithium. So it's one of those that is kind of abundant in some form. So you should be able to get it. And if not, the amount of lithium you need in a battery is very small compared to everything else. The worst case, you bring it from Earth. The main thing is, like, how do we actually refine these minerals and do that process? Now,
that's a good thing that Elon and Tesla is doing that right now, lithium refinery, so they could take
So I'm kind of wondering about, it's like, and they're looking in the lithium refinery. I wonder what it's about. But the other thing is that occurred to me is that if you are going to manufacture batteries on Mars, I mean, manufacturing anything is going to be tough. You know, you're just thinking of, like, oh, the infrastructure of having a smelter and all this other stuff that you might want to have. Now, if you look at battery production, we know we kind of look at the footprint there, and it's like, wow, you know, it's like all these ovens. And remember, I talked about heat being a problem, you know, heating on Mars. So if you got an industrial process that needs a lot of heat, you might want to think twice about that. Mm-hmm. And so you need the ovens and everything else. And then it's like, well, there is a new manufacturing process for batteries that requires 1/10 the footprint and doesn't require any heat. And it's called the dry electrode process.
Ah, the dry electrode, of course.
The 4680s is about Mars.
Wow. Yeah,
it's about Mars. And it's about making some way of being able to manufacture batteries with very simple raw materials coming in that you figured out, and that you can just build this thing and then send it up there. So we don't have to come up with, like, a gigafactory. Now, we don't have to at first, because remember, we're building these really big battery plants because we need batteries for 8 billion people. We don't have 8 billion people on Mars yet. We've got a small number. We're talking about half dozen, you know, eventually 100, and then it gets a bit. So at that point, we don't have to pump out a lot of batteries. So you can probably come up with some sort of small manufacturing unit that'd be able to produce them at a reasonable level, at the scale that you need for it. So that's the thing I was saying. It's like, oh, okay. It's like every time you look at something, it's like there is a reason for that. So the 4680s, I think a lot of that has to do with Mars and not just relying on methane. It will be important. That's going to be a very important constituent for being able to get back, but also to be able to run equipment. And like I say, if you need heating and you need a lot of heat right away.
And then tell me about bots, your favorite topic.
Well, the bots are going to be the first starting out. Yeah, they'll be the first ones there. They're going to be the scouts, and I think they would probably go in the very first mission. So a lot of the ideas that there'd be these automated spacecraft that would just, you know, go down there, a few little things would happen, set up the reactors and everything, and go. And the idea is it's just like almost automated, no humanoids or humans needed. But that might change. So now the idea of having the bot there is it can do a lot of the scouting that would be necessary for good sites, looking around where the mineral deposits are, being able to service equipment, make sure if anything is wrong, being able to take care of it, setting up a lot of the habitats. So, at first the idea is like, you're just going to live in your spacecraft until you can set up your campsite or something like that. But you might be able to come there and it's like, wow, look, everything is already set up and ready. The other thing that's going to be important, as we learned from Boca Chica, is when you land, you're going to create quite the dust storm. So we don't even have a concrete pad there. We just have the regolith, and we're just going to be kicking that regolith up all over the place. And you may need to be able to prepare something. And so there are some ideas out there on how you could do something to prepare the soil. They've even talked about like laser sintering and stuff like that that are very interesting. But some of them might just involve the bots going out and preparing something so you have a kind of a landing pad, so when you come down, you are not creating this dust storm, which is just going to create all sorts of havoc and issues and potentially compromise the craft when it comes down. Because the last thing you want that to happen is that you crash just before you're ready to land because something got kicked up. So that will be important. The bots are going to do a lot. And the other thing, hopefully, they might be setting up the greenhouses. Because as you know, there's a lead time for food production.
Yeah. So you think it's going to be greenhouses and it's going to be real plants and real, food rather than manufactured food?
Oh, there's going to be different. There's probably, I know Tony Seba has talked a lot about the precision fermentation. So there's definitely going to be a certain amount of that. And certainly we can see that Kimball Musk is, he's working on those ideas for sure on how you would be able to come up with hydroponics and other ways of being able to do it. The first thing you need is soil. So the biggest problem is the Martian regolith is full of these peroxides that you need to be able to clear those out. Perchlorates. And they're very hazardous to anything, and you really can't grow anything with it. So they would need a certain amount of processing. But it's believed that that can be done, and that you would be able to then use that as your feedstock inside some sort of greenhouses that would obviously not be outside. We need to make sure that they stay warm and hydrated. And you would need some sort of bot to go around and tend them and make sure they're up and growing, so that when they land, they have everything. And it's going to be more than greenhouses. It's going to be this big cycle with all sorts of things. So, ideas that you would probably have maybe even some fish that you'd be able to bring along, because fish will probably be the easiest of, if you were going to bring any sort of, I don't know if you want to call that livestock. I mean, bringing chickens and cows, that's just not going to happen. There's very few things that we can think of, but fish kind of makes sense because it's very easy to transport the fish eggs over a long period of time. When they get there, okay, now you've got them. And hopefully, and then you can find them, and they may be very good at being able to, put algae in the water and these other things, come up with a cycle that they can clean the water, produce a lot of nutrients. You get this closed ecosystem to produce everything that you need. And once you get the greenhouses, of course, what's one of the things the greenhouses will produce? They like taking in CO2. They like producing oxygen. So that means we don't have to worry that much about how our oxygen production is done. We can do that. And eventually that scales up and gets bigger and bigger. And then hopefully at some point we could talk about these big algae ponds or cyanobacteria that creates lots and lots of oxygen by feeding all that stuff. And that'll be part of the terraforming, because that's how Earth was terraformed. Earth was terraformed. It wasn't like this. It didn't start out this way. It started out very, very differently. And then eventually a cyanobacteria came around and over a couple hundred million years converted the atmosphere from this toxic atmosphere, whatever it was, to the atmosphere we enjoy today. So that was a long process. That's why I say you need time. You know, a lot of time, even though you're talking about trillions of these organisms that are just able to do that every day, but they got to do it over a long period of time, and they need energy. So they needed all the energy that the sun was bringing to the Earth over a 100 million year period. So can we speed that up? I don't know. But if we, actually use biology to do it, it'll probably be slow.
Okay, so let's see. You talked about reusable rockets to get us out there. We talked about robots as scouts to get us in there. We talked about underground tunnels with the boring, possibly for some parts of it, solar panels, energy storage, maybe the HVAC, maybe not the HVAC. And then what about the electric vehicles? So Cybertruck going to be there. And And what about brain-computer interface? Is that even necessary? You talked about Starlink being used to communicate, but do you even need to have Neuralink somehow? Is that even associated, or is that completely nothing to do with Mars?
That's hard to say. I don't see how Neuralink fits in the picture. Doesn't mean it doesn't. It doesn't mean someone doesn't have a grand scheme. Just that I'm not smart enough to see how that would work. You know, I can see how the boring machine would work. I can see how potentially working on some of these HVAC is HVAC is about climate control of some sort. And so you're going to need that. And I'm sure they'll be able to come up with some sort of breakthroughs to figure out how to make it more efficient. So you need to have that's for sure. You know, obviously, the communication is very important with Starlink and the technology they're developing there. And you know, using lasers to be able to communicate between different spacecraft is very important. It's going to be done that way because that's the only way you can get the bandwidth that you would need. There may be a need for some small nuclear reactors. Robert Zubrin has said you definitely need that for the jumpstart. So that might be something that they jumpstart on, something maybe they work on because Elon is not opposed to the idea. Right. Of different kinds of nuclear reactors that make sense in some places. So I would not be surprised if they're not thinking about making something that's small and portable. We're not talking about, one of the huge plants that's here, but something that would be able to work and be efficient. And there's a lot of different ideas out there that are not necessarily uranium-based, like some of these thorium breeder reactors and others, some that could almost be very, very compact. So I see that. You know, the interesting thing and why heat's going to be a problem is that we think when we go into a cave or we take the regolith that the earth makes this great insulation. So a lot of times we will see people in cold climates that's like, yeah, you build your house kind of into the ground and it's going to give a certain amount of warmth. It's like, well, on the earth, the average temperature when you go down a little bit might be around 59 degrees. So it's not really warm, but it's not really that cold. And in a very cold winter's day can provide a certain amount of warmth insulation. The problem is the ground temperature. I'm not talking about the ground temperature. Like I say, it's like minus 55 degrees centigrade. It will probably be the worst form of insulation almost because you build your habitat and you're putting it up against this very massive thing, this massive heat source or sink at this point, which is at minus 55 degrees centigrade. It probably is not going to be the best form of insulation. You're going to have to make something between that. It's going to be great for stopping incoming radiation, but it's not exactly going to be like, the pink insulation that you put into your home. So it will have to be changed a little bit. And so there may be some sort of chemistries and other ways of being able to do that. So vapor barriers and others that you sort of build between it to minimize the transfer of that. Because otherwise you're heating at, and rather than the heat being contained, it's just kind of being sucked in by the Mars itself and trying to pull it away. So
are you going to need a 3D printer or something like that? Is there
Everything's going to be 3D. So a lot of the houses, the habitats, may be 3D printed ahead of time. So we've seen these construction of houses with concrete where the 3D printer comes out there. And there have been a lot of proposals. You can see YouTube channels that are showing that. Real serious proposals of how you would build it and the kind of robotic arms. And these are very simple kind of robotic arms that spin around. And how they can take the regolith and then transform that. And so you just need to make sure you find enough supplies. So there's going to have to be some water on there. There may be some other important constituents that you need to put in concrete that hopefully you can find locally, or you're going to have to bring that. But for the most part, when you mix concrete here on Earth, a small amount of it is what the Portland cement or whatever is the binding agent, but the majority of it is the aggregate. So if we have to bring that from Earth, I guess we do. But at least the aggregate, which is 90%, we can probably get it locally. So that should not be a big challenge. We can do a lot of it locally. Some stuff we bring. And eventually, the industry will get better and better. But it's all about micro factories. That's what Mars is going to be doing. Everything's going to be micro factories, which may be to a big benefit on Earth. Because right now, everything is so centralized with our manufacturing and everything. Elon complains about how things have to get moved like all over the place, that every product you have, the constituent elements that are in there have probably gone around the earth like 7 or 8 times before they finally make it in there. And a lot of it is because the manufacturing is off somewhere else. But if you can start to make these micro factories and these materials come in, you don't have to have that big economy. That might be something that you do on Mars because you have to. And then you realize, hey, we can use it back home.
Yeah, this is one of my predictions is that when I was able to speak to Elon and I asked them a question, I asked them, are you guys working on solving global world hunger? And he said, we are. Kimball. And he, did his normal reply, which is there is no caloric deficit on Earth. And right. Then he stopped. But what his answer would have been, if we heard him talk about it, is there's no caloric deficit. What it is about delivering the food that we all can make to the right person at the right place at the right time. And of course, there's corruption and all that that's causing those issues yes. with poverty and everything else. But in order to do this in Mars, I think they're going to have to do 3D printing and probably 3D yes, printing of both absolutely. Food and equipment. And so that's mm-hmm. Only way to do it. Like every home in every location, if you're in Africa or something like that, you should be able to create your own food at that location where you are whenever you need to. And so I'm still thinking that that's the missing technology that they'll right, probably right. come up with one day.
And there are schemes to be able to 3D print different foods, but you still need some sort of feedstock. Yeah. And the same thing with this idea of precision fermentation, which is kind of close to that you just need to be able to produce these certain things. You just need some certain key ingredients. And those are things that you would probably have to grow locally. And maybe it's not a whole lot. And once you have those, that you've got some sort of carbohydrate sources, you get some sort of protein sources, some sort of fat or lipid yeah. sources, they're able to create, boom, you just kind of put them together and you can make almost anything you want at that point. And there's going to be a lot of genetic engineering. So there's going to be a lot of algae and bacteria or yeast. I think primarily it's used that they're going to do a little bit of tinkering with that to be able to produce these certain proteins that you want. So you'll be able to have ice cream on Mars, even though there will not be any cows on Mars. I guarantee there will not be any cows on Mars. And right. It's not clear there'll be any chickens on Mars, but you'll probably still be able to have something that tastes and resembles an omelet like or a hamburger. So those things will be possible because we're already seeing it back home here that we're doing that. And it absolutely makes sense on Mars. And there's one other picture that we can kind of show, which is sort of shows the idea of what the Mars colony might look like someday. Mm-hmm. So again, here you see the landing pads to make sure that when they land, they don't create a big dust storm, mm-hmm. make it far enough away from the city. And it looks a bit like a printed circuit board, which is, I think, mm-hmm. what Elon has referenced many times. And you can see all the different habitats. You're going to have greenhouses there. You're going to have probably gymnasiums. You're going to have mm-hmm. places where people live, where they like to congregate. It looks like there's probably some solar farms out there. Everything you could imagine you would need in the city that will slowly grow. But at first, it's going to be a very small settlement. It really is going to be an outpost that we'll all be cheering on from Earth and hoping they're doing well and resupplying them. And when they're ready, we're going to come in with more stuff and more stuff. One of the biggest challenges with Mars is what the growth plan is going to be like. Is we're used to this idea of a pipeline, right? Once you get a supply chain kind of going, things come at a reliable rate at the end. And so I know I need a certain amount of stuff, and so it just kind of comes in a certain way. So if I need milk, I just go to the store and I get milk. But if it's one of those things that, the milk gets delivered once every 2 years at the store, then I have to go to the store and buy 2 years worth of milk. Mm-hmm. And so that means your supply lines are very complicated because you have to deliver so much in one shot that you then have to use up over a 2 year period. And so when the colony starts growing, it's going to happen in these waves. That's why Elon is talking about like 1,000 starships. And while mm-hmm. that sounds rather interesting, it's also a bit crazy because you're going to have these people that have sort of created a settlement that's working fine for a dozen people. Mm-hmm. And suddenly you're going to have this huge wave. Is it going to really be 1,000 that are coming in, or is the next one going to be, let's keep it maybe around 10 to, so the robots might be important to really scale that up. So if you want to send 1,000 ships with humans there, then something really has to be ready. So it's going to have to be almost like this Fibonacci kind of thing. You start out small, get a little bit bigger, a little bit bigger, a little bit bigger. Yeah. You just don't say, all right, we got the settlement. A few things are there. We've been there twice now. Maybe we've gone ahead and we set the scout ships out there where the robots are set up for the first humans that came in. They proved that they can live there. Everything's fine. Now let's send the whole, it's not going to work that way. It's going to be a couple of steps, which is probably like, Elon is talking about, 2050 is when you would be able to get to that million mark. So I don't see 1,000 starships going there in 2030 or, even 2040, that might be kind of crazy. It's going to be
a little bit longer. Reusable rockets is so critical.
Because there's the other problem we might want to get to, and that is Mars habitable and will it ever be habitable? And what do we have to do to make sure any sort of colony, the first foothold, will be survival? We don't want a Jamestown. We want a Plymouth.
Okay. Gotcha.
So what are the steps that are going to be kind of involved in that? And the first thing is you have to find the right landing zones to have. Okay. Now, to point out that, you know, there's a lot of hazards. The first hazard is getting there in the first place. And the biggest hazard on getting there in the first place is cosmic radiation. So there's a lot of radiation coming in. There has to be some way to make the spacecraft a little bit impervious to it. And that's very difficult. I mean, there's a couple of ways. One is you lead line it, but you don't want to lead line it because lead is very, very heavy. So you want to do something lighter. The other thing is it turns out water is pretty good at blocking a lot of those things. So the idea is that you somehow make the outside of the spacecraft or where you're primarily spending your time in or sleeping surround. So you're almost like in an aquarium the whole time.
Aquarium.
So that would help block it to reduce it because the transit is pretty bad because in space it's coming from you in all directions. Once you get down on the planet, now you only have to worry about it coming to you from half, just from the sky, because the planet itself will block that from you. So you don't have to worry about that. There's other things probably from the surface you have to worry about, you know, like the perchlorates and, you know, maybe if there's other radiation hazards down there. But as far as cosmic radiation, it's only going to be coming from the sky. So now on Earth, we don't have to worry about it because our thick atmosphere does a very good job of blocking that. The Martian atmosphere is so thin, it does not. Most of it's able to come through. And so you want to look places on Mars that are as low as possible. And, you know, there are... So the first place you want to be on Mars is where it's as warm as possible, which means the equator, right? So that's the first thing. The second thing is that you want to get some places as low as possible. So the blue areas are very, very low. So the lower you get, you actually get a little bit more atmosphere. And it may not seem like very much, but actually is substantial in that it can help cut down the radiation exposure a lot. So the blue areas are good. And I know Jordan Wright, the angry astronaut, he's a big fan of Mariner's. And for all sorts of reasons. One, it's very low. So you would want to be somewhere over in this area here, and it's down along the equator. And he thinks it's absolutely scenic. So the problem with a lot of sites, like when we landed on the moon, and actually a lot of the spacecraft that we've landed on Mars, land in these very prosaic kind of places just because they're very easy to land. You don't have to worry about many boulders or geological features or anything, but they're just boring. So you want to go to some place. So do you really want to land in like a place that's like the middle of the Sahara Desert and say, oh, this is your new home. There's nothing to see. You want to go someplace where you can actually maybe explore and discover certain things. And a valley, I mean, think about the Grand Canyon. The Grand Canyon has exposed Earth's history. It's all there. So geologically, the place you want to be is in the Grand Canyon of Mars. And that's much bigger than the Grand Canyon. And also the cliff sides are the valley goes up extremely high. So there's a couple of advantages there. One is like those cliff sides also provide a little bit of extra protection from incoming radiation. And you're a little bit deeper and you see some spots that are very deep. The other thing is that when Zubrin came out with his book, it wasn't clear if there was any water on Mars. I mean, there's speculation that there could have been, that there may have been there, but it may all be gone. But there now seems to be indication there are some water ices and there might be some subterranean water that we could tap into. And the one thing we all know is that water likes to seek its lowest point. So, you know, start at the lowest point and then you might be a chance of finding some water very close to that surface right there. And so if we find water, we don't have to schlep the hydrogen there anymore. We will have that already there. We don't have to make the water anymore. It's there. And we, through electrolysis, will be able to create the hydrogen we need for the methane and more O2 that we would need for everything else. So that is that would be sort of one of the areas. And there's a couple other reasons to want to be there. Now, the habitats we have, people talked about, do we want to go in like lava tubes or caves or something like that? You know, maybe the boring tunnels would be able to provide something because that would give adequate protection. We can also use the Martian regolith to help build these homes that are covered. So if we have enough of that, we don't have to worry about coming in. But you still want to have some sort of sunlight. So no one really wants to live in a cave. I mean, I know there's a woman who just spent 500 days in a cave in Spain, but I mean, you do want to come out and see the sunlight and everything else. And just for your psychology.
is Martian soil. That's basically the soil, right? Martian soil. And are you talking about like an igloo kind of thing, but made out of soil?
Yes, exactly. A hut? Exactly. So, okay. So the whole idea is you probably have like this inflatable hut, and then you just put a lot of the regolith on top to give you the thickness, because you don't want to bring the concrete from Earth. That's, you know, you just can't do it. Okay. So you're going to have to use something local. So you'll do that. The other thing is that you just go into hillsides or somewhere else and not worry about that. But the thing is, like, well, you're not seeing any sunlight the whole day. So there are these ideas of habitats that have windows. Now, the windows will probably be actually made out of water or ice, literally ice, because they will block the incoming cosmic radiation much better than glass. But from the horizon, it's not a problem. It's really only from the top. Now, the one thing I want to ask you, Herbert, when's the last time you stared directly into the sun? Now, I know you're in Seattle, so it's probably pretty rare, but when's the last time you looked straight into the sun?
I don't remember, yeah.
Oh,
in Hawaii, maybe, I don't know.
I will bet, mm-hmm. I bet you've done it a couple times a year or maybe almost once a month, even though you're always told never look straight in the sun. No. Mm-hmm. When the sun's setting.
Oh, yes, of course. I see. Gotcha. Yeah. That's right. Now, that's a trick question.
Yeah, so that's the same thing on Mars, is that, you know, from the horizon, and the reason why you can do that is because you're looking through so much atmosphere compared to when you're looking straight up. So you're looking through hundreds and hundreds of miles of atmosphere versus what might just be, you know, 10 miles of atmosphere going up, or 20 miles, or whatever you want to say it's going up, because it gets very thin. So you have a lot more of the thick atmosphere, which is why you're not blinded by the sun when it's down low. So it's the same thing that sort of happens on the horizon in Mars. You don't have to worry so much about the cosmic radiation there. But there's like, you know, maybe 130, 120 degrees that you're a little bit worried. So you just make sure you have adequate shielding over there and you allow the light to be able to come in. So that's what you want to do. Now, the other thing you can try to do to improve this is that if we can increase the atmosphere of Mars at all, things will get better. So we already see, if you go to the blue spots, they're much better than being over by the yellow or the red spots. Yeah. And that's just an altitude difference there. So what can we do to improve it? Well, it turns out, if you want to do the terraforming, there's a couple things that you need. One, you need the resources. So hopefully they're there. If not, you're going to have to bring them from somewhere else. You need energy, and you probably need time. So a lot of times when they think about the resources, like, well, if we want to bring the water escapes, we're going to have to bring the water back from somewhere, unless the water happens to be hiding underneath. But we think a lot of it probably boiled off and went in there, along with a lot of the atmosphere. But some of it seems to have condensed. And that's why at the poles, there is basically solid carbon dioxide, or what you would call dry ice up there. And we see seasonally, it kind of goes up and down depending on the temperature. So it seems like there's a good supply of carbon dioxide at the poles. Just like there's a good supply of water ice on Earth, and we know that if you melt that our oceans are going to rise because of the excess. And the same thing on Mars. Like, let's basically do the same thing there, except we want the atmosphere to fill up. And if we do that, we start to get more pressure, and that changes a lot of things, and especially would help that. So, you know, there has been the idea of, you know, nuke Mars, which I'm not sure that everyone has said the energy you need for that is not going to be quite enough. But if you do something to supplement, then you would increase the Martian pressure quite a bit. And then by doing that, you'll actually get more warmth. And then you get this vicious cycle that it makes it more likely to supplement, and other kind of volatile gases may be able to come out, and you can start to increase the atmospheric pressure somehow. It's not clear there's enough to give us, you know, the kind of atmospheric pressure we used to hear on Earth. Because first, they don't quite have the gravity, and we would need a bulky amount of it. But eventually, maybe we're bringing that in from the asteroids or from somewhere else, where we might be able to find a lot of those volatiles, because we believe that's where the water and the atmosphere of the Earth came from, was cometary bombardment. So we just, we have artificial lakes on Earth. Well, we can have an artificial atmosphere by just speeding up the process of nature. But before we do that, there is one very important question that we have to answer or solve, and that is, why did Mars lose its atmosphere in the first place? Mm-hmm. Any idea why? Now, first, when I was a kid, that would have been a very controversial statement, because we thought Mars didn't have an atmosphere ever. But now there seems to be a lot of evidence that it probably had an atmosphere, a very thick atmosphere, and it probably had oceans like Earth. So there is pretty much a lot of consensus that it's there. And then why did it go away? Well, it went away for a couple reasons. One is Mars is smaller than the Earth, which means its gravitational attraction is a little bit smaller. So it's a lot easier for the gases to escape. And the other is because it's smaller, Mars cooled off earlier. And what's one thing that Earth has that Mars doesn't have that is not necessarily an atmosphere? And that, as you might know, is a magnetosphere. Mm-hmm. The reason we have a magnetosphere is because the Earth's core is molten. And we believe that it comes from the fact that you have these currents being generated from the actual flow and movement of the a lot of the magma in the core that creates this dynamo effect that creates a magnetic field that surrounds the Earth. And that's very important because the solar wind, which is all these particles coming off the sun, if they impinge with the upper part of the atmosphere, are able to hit the molecules there enough and give them enough energy that they now actually have escape velocity and they get peeled off. So you get this atmospheric erosion from that happening, and the magnetosphere protects Earth from that. And they believe what happened is about a billion years ago, Mars cooled down so much that its core is now solid. It lost its magnetic field. Now the solar wind came in and stripped it away. So before you can do anything about terraforming and the idea of bringing the atmosphere back, you got to solve that problem. And if you solve that problem, you get rid of some of the radiation problem, because it's not just cosmic radiation that you have to deal with on Mars. It's also like the solar wind, the, you know, what's coming in from there. So we do want to get protected from that. So there are some ideas for that. And the first thing I want to do is I want to talk about Lagrange points. Are you familiar with the idea of Lagrange points?
No.
Okay, so let me bring this. Now, there are two videos I think everyone should see. This first one, and are we displaying it right now? Yeah, okay. So this is from Isaac Arthur, who has a great channel that speculates all sorts of things. And this is about, you know, talking about different ways of being able to make a magnetosphere on Mars. And part of it is the description of the Lagrange points. And these are points of stability between different planetary bodies. And it's, so this is an example of Mars, or sorry, the Earth and the Moon. And there's a point right between Earth and the Moon where the gravitational fields have both become equal. So in other words, you're being pulled equally in both directions to either fall towards Earth or to fall towards Mars or towards the Moon. Mm-hmm. And that's called Lagrange point one. And it turns out it's a point of stability. So what do you think about it is, like, you know, if you have a hill where you go up the hill with your bicycle, when you get to the top of the hill, there's all these different directions you can go down there. But it seems very unstable because the slightest nudge and you're going to kind of go over. So imagine you kind of go up there, and maybe it's going to be a marble you're going to put up there, but you get like just a little dimple up at the top that you can kind of rest in, that you're kind of stable there. But if you get just enough of a nudge, you kind of fall out of it and you're going to go off in a different direction. And it turns out these become like virtual masses almost. You can actually orbit around it. As a matter of fact, L2 is where the James Webb telescope right now is orbiting right around there. So it's actually to go around here. And then I think the Lunar Gateway, the idea is to do some kind of weird thing around L1. But there's all these different points of stability. And if you looked at this as being the sun instead, and this as being Mars, Mars also has a couple. And these here is where Starlink would put their satellites. Because these are stable orbits that actually lead either in front or behind it. So it's a very stable point. You don't have to have it in an orbit underneath where they're always spinning around. You put it there and it almost becomes like a geosat. It's always in the same place in the sky as far as you're concerned. So that is what Starlink is going to do. Now, the other reason for these is that this has something to do with the magnetosphere. And another one of my favorite YouTubers out there is Anton Petrov. And he covers all sorts of great topics in physics and space and astronomy. And when I saw this a few years ago, this was talking about a proposal from NASA to create a magnetic field around Mars. And it uses the L1 point. So this is the L1 point over here, and this is Mars. So actually you're thinking, well, let's just create a big magnetic field out here with a satellite with a big solar array and just make a huge magnetic field that will then protect Mars.
Gotcha.
And because the L1 is always the same relationship between Mars and the sun, as it orbits around, it's not orbiting faster or slower than Mars, but it's locked in there. So it's always in the same position. So it's a really cool idea. And of course, when I first heard about that, read the headline, I had like the imagination, oh, they're going to boot up the the magnetic field of Mars. How awesome. And then I saw this and I was like, oh, disappointed. And then I went home and I said, oh, why did they do this? And now this is my crazy idea that no one's really going to do. I was like, well, wait a minute. why don't they just get like one of those, a really big 16 penny nail like I had as a kid, and just like drive it from the North Pole to the South Pole, put some telephone wire around thing, plug it to a really big D cell, and then just create a field
batter.
And so I'm just imagining, it's like, could you do that? I said, well, wait a minute. You know what you could do is that you already have, you know, once you get through the crust, there is already like iron down there. So you already have like a conducting loop. And I'm sort of wondering, it's like, well, what if you were able to tunnel around in some sort of helical pattern around there? And then I'm thinking, well, how would you boot this thing up and get the energy? And I'm almost wondering, and this is crazy. This is where some physicists are going to come in and say, well, you're not right. Or maybe one of them will say, hey, he's onto something. Is the aurora borealis is a result of the solar wind being redirected to the poles. So you have all these charged particles that are streaming down the poles and just crashing into the atmosphere and energizing with all this light. That's a current. And I'm almost thinking, well, wait a minute. What I should do is, like, you know, that's my battery. Stick a big antenna up there, capture this thing that we're kind of pulling in. And so if you're able to bootstrap it and kind of get the field going, it might be you could almost energize the field by capturing the solar wind. Now, it's a crazy idea. I've talked to some guys who are physicists. You really can't do it, but it'll make a great science fiction story someday for anyone out there trying to think about how you go ahead and boot it. So as crazy as that sounds, it turns out, you know, this was about 5 years ago, this video. The one from Isaac Arthur was about a year ago, and it was based on this paper. Okay, how to create an artificial magnetosphere for Mars. And one of the ideas was that you actually could restart the iron core, but they're not thinking about boring on down there. They're thinking about, like, literally taking wires and wrapping it around the equator, which is the same way, same idea. And then booting it. And, you know, the question is, where do you get the energy? But, you know, there's really serious thoughts, like, we could do that. So it wasn't that crazy. And that if there's some way to do it. Now, here's my crazier one. This one you're really going to love. Are you a fan of MacGyver?
Of course.
Okay. All right. Now, do you know how magnets are made?
No.
Especially the rare earth magnets that you see? No. Like, because we know the rare earth magnets are needed in the Tesla motors and everything else. And I just assumed, like, oh, you just like put the stuff in here, you know, and melt it down and get into shape and poof, it's a magnet, right? It's like, no. When you put it in there, it's not magnetized at all. So you have to magnetize it. And it turns out you have to take the solid material that you have there, put it into a magnetic field, and then hit it really hard with a hammer.
Oh, really?
And then, like, you give it that, and then the crystals will start to align with it. So you bang it a couple times. It's like, wow, that's really weird. Because I always assume it, like, when it solidified, because a lot of the lodestones that the Greeks found and everything like that was igneous rock that when it froze, solidified, it then picked up whatever the local magnetic field was, which is why they had this property of magnetism. But there was like an episode of MacGyver where he actually, you know, he needed to come up with a magnet because he dropped his keys down in the sewer grate or something like that.
Okay.
And he was like half wounded and it was like really hard. And he ended up finding like a metal crowbar. And it's explaining, all you have to do is like take it and bang it a bunch of times and it will magnetize and go down there and do it. It's like, wow. So that's how you make a magnet. So I'm thinking, all right, let's see if we can turn this core into a big magnet. Okay. So it'll be a static magnet. It doesn't have to be a dynamic magnet. And the one thing we need to do is we need to hit it really hard.
Sure.
And we need to have a really strong magnetic field at the same time. So, but some of the other things that Earth is, or that Mars is missing, is like maybe, you know, some volatiles and a little bit of extra mass here and there. So, like, let's redirect it. An asteroid towards Mars that's big enough,
right?
That when it hits, it's just going to ring that thing like a bell. All right. Yeah. And when that happens, you make sure you have a fusion bomb somewhere, because the whole thing about a nuclear bomb is you get the EMP, the electromagnetic pulse. And so you get like this big magnetic field. It's like, well, just time that thing and just boom, boom. And then, you get it. All right. So that's my crazy idea for being able to restart the magnetic field of Mars. Again, pure science fiction. Never going to happen, but I'm going to put it out there. So
Elon did talk about nuking Mars, North Poles, and the poles.
Right,
under,
right.
Now, something similar.
The thing I want to point out is like on this whole idea of terraforming Mars, if the whole idea is like, we're going to start this project to terraform Mars to make it verdant Mars, like in that image, that is generations and generations away. I mean, the most optimistic is that it's a couple hundred years. I mean, realistically, it's more like millennia. And probably the only science fiction series that maybe captured that properly was The Expanse, where, you know, in the Expanse, they started to terraform Mars and they realized this is really hard and gave up on it, you know, after 200 years, to realize that we just hadn't made any progress. Because again, you need lots of energy, you need lots of resources, and you're just going to need lots of time. Now, it doesn't mean we don't get started, but we make sure that whatever we do is going to provide benefit to the generation now. It'll, of course, it's going to help future generations, but we have to kind of do something because, of course, we're the beneficiaries of like a lot of the roads that were started to be built over 100 years ago, and all we did was start to pave them and everything else, and the railroads had already been there. So we've been building on what our ancestors had built for us, and it'll be the same thing. But part of it is, what do you try to do to thicken the atmosphere at least a little bit? Getting that magnetic field started will probably be the top one. So you would do that. And so you want to look at, you know, there's the long term, which is quite a bit. There's kind of the midterm. And then we have to get right down to the short term. The short term is like finding the right spot, making sure you have enough that you can get that outpost. You can prove that the outpost can survive. And then once you do that, and so long as that outpost is there, you're committed. I mean, not only are they committed, Earth is committed. Yeah. They have to send supplies routinely.
Let's talk about the society. So it obviously, it just makes so much sense now that he's got the Twitter and turning into the everything app and having the X coin and being a financial transaction, being, you know, entertainment, being, so it's got commerce, it's got voting in it. It will be kind of the new way. And he's talked about what kind of a government was he talking about? Come this way.
That this is a direct democracy that you vote on everything. And, you know, I thought that that would sort of make sense. You already do that kind of as a shareholder. So every shareholder gets to vote on every resolution, but you have a board of directors, which would probably be a governing body that maybe makes recommendations on what they think would be the wisest thing, or maybe they try to craft or come up with legislation. So you might still have some kind of legislative body, but in the end, when it comes to a vote, those legislators may represent certain districts and they may have the proxies of those, so that you just sign this proxy statement to say that legislator can vote however he wants. I'm with him. Or you might be like, don't trust the guy. I didn't really vote for him. He wasn't my guy. This is what my vote's going to be. And that means every single piece of legislation that goes up there, everyone gets a vote on it. It's not just a small crew of people where, you know, corruption and all sorts of influence peddling, where they sort of trade votes back and forth because, you know, I'm really against this legislation, but there's this other one I want. So you do the horse trading, and that's what causes these systems to break. So it really is going to come down to that everyone is able to vote. They'll be able to vote anonymously, so no one really knows what anyone else's vote, so you can vote your conscience. And so that will be a true direct democracy, which the American experiment wanted to do something like that. It just wasn't practical because we didn't have the ability to communicate like that. You know, it took such a long time to get to the Continental Congress and everything else, the horseback and with mail. But, you know, now the technology has changed. So governing bodies really have to think about that, and that we make sure we get real-time information. I mean, look today, the Fed raised interest rates again. And Elon's been saying, it's old data. You're making this decision on data that is very, very old. So again, the idea is that you will have all the information that you need right there at your fingertips to make the decision that makes sense real time today on what is the best thing. And
so I agree. Getting to Mars, obviously, it's an impossible dream. But actually, when you stop and think about what Elon and Tesla and all the other companies have achieved at this point, right? Reusable market rockets, number one, because you have to get, like you said, to 1,000 trips. And then the robots is number two. If you got robots, it actually solves a lot of things. As you were sharing your information, it made me, you know, you basically said it, that you don't need a lot of things on the first, second, or even third visit. You don't need to worry about food. You can take years to develop the food, because if you've got robots, you don't need the sustainable atmosphere, the protection. Those kinds that can be built by the robots, and it could take years before you get there. That's one. And so the other thing I think that's missing is, like I said, some sort of 3D printer, home builder, anything else you think that's absolutely critical that hasn't been built yet, which therefore is your prediction of what the next company that Elon might be announcing, some sort of food?
Yeah. I mean, I know they'd be doing a lot in the food. So there would be, Tesla is really good at manufacturing. and SpaceX. So Elon recognizes that the key to everything is manufacturing and how you revolutionize that. And there's a lot of these different components that are coming in there. And some of it, of course, is 3D printing. But, you know, the main thing with 3D printing is you need feedstocks. So you've got to figure out, well, how do I get the material that I need for this? And it's going to be a bit tricky because we use a lot of plastics down here on Earth. Right. Where do plastics come from? You know, they come from fossil fuels. Oh, you don't have a lot of that. So what's the feedstock going to be for that? But not all 3D printing has to be plastic. It could be a lot of these other materials. So they're going to have to figure out how to maybe make those materials. And there are bio ways of being able to create bioplastics that could be used. So you would see something there. But I think a lot of it is going to be in the refining. You know, how do you come up with a more efficient way of refining things without having these just huge factories? We have to keep them small. So everything has to be a micro factory and thinking of keeping small footprints and making everything so it's not energy intensive to be able to do it. And then the other thing is just going to be learning how to recycle and reuse everything. So it's going to be a very, very closed loop ecosystem. So as I was mentioning, there's no such thing as waste heat on Mars. So you're not going to have an industrial process which is just like, oh, we've got to get rid of this heat. There's not going to be an effluent or something like that that you get rid of because, oh, we don't need it. It's like, no, it's going to be useful over here somewhere else. So everything is going to be tied together and in order for that to work successfully. And we can learn a lot of that stuff here on Earth because we need to. Everyone was complaining. It's like, we don't have enough water on Earth. It's like, we got plenty of water. You know, all we have to do is take the water that we have and turn it into fresh water more efficiently. So it's there. It's just kind of finding a way to take the resources. We have a lot of these other resources. The problem is we tend to chuck them out rather than saying, oh, we can take them and recycle them and use them. So again, like lithium, everyone says, oh, we don't have enough lithium for all the batteries. Yeah. Like, well, we do. And eventually we won't have to mine lithium anymore. We're going to figure out how to recycle it. And Mars is about a recycling economy. You will not throw any scrap out. Yeah. Absolutely everything's going to be used. So, I mean, to me, that's the most important, maybe, you know, new thing is that Elon's company would be something that is really into a reusable economy of some sort.
Yeah. Well, now that they brought back J.B. Straubel and Redwood Materials, I think that recycling is the next division that they're going to be either buying, acquiring Redwood Materials or growing. And so, yeah, these are good thoughts, Scott. Very nice.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. All right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wonderful. Thank you, Scott. So, you know, please follow Scott on Twitter under the handle @goingballistic5. Hopefully you learned something new and we're going to bring him back on again. But that was great. You covered a lot of the technologies that Elon is and, you know, the Musk Industries that are working on. And after talking to you, it feels like it's actually doable. Your dream's going to come true.
It's hard. I know we're going to, I really believe that in my lifetime, I will see.
It's going to happen.
Humans on Mars. I really believe it's going to be there. But it's going to be tough sledding to be able to get up to that. But I think once we're there, we're up to the challenge. Human beings can do amazing things when they decide that they want to. And all you need, like Elon says, that a reason to get up in the morning. And this is a reason for a lot of people to get up in the morning. It's exciting.
It is exciting. Okay. Thanks, everybody. See you next time.